open, the pressure will remain constant. Although it might not provide the relaxing, high water pressure experience you'd anticipated, the pressure in the shower will not drop any further once the water has completely spread throughout all extra outlets. Similarly, once the gravitational field has completely spread throughout the extra curled-up dimension, it will not diminish with further separation. From your data, you would deduce two things. First, from the fact that the gravitational force diminished in proportion to distance when objects are very close, you'd realize that the universe has two space dimensions, not one. Second, from the crossover to a gravitational force that is constant, the result known from hundreds of years of previous experiments, you'd conclude that one of these dimensions is curled up, with a size about equal to the distance at which the crossover takes place. And with this result, you'd overturn centuries, if not millennia, of belief regarding something so basic, the number of space dimensions, that it seemed almost beyond questioning. Although I set this story in a lower-dimensional universe, for visual ease, our situation could be much the same. Hundreds of years of experiments have confirmed that gravity varies inversely with the square of distance, giving strong evidence that there are three space dimensions. But as of 1998, no experiment had ever probed gravity's strength on separations smaller than a millimeter. Today, as mentioned, this has been pushed to a tenth of a millimeter. This led Savas Dimopoulos of Stanford, Nima Arkani Hamed, now of Harvard, and Giyad Vali of New York University, to propose that, in the brain world scenario, extra dimensions could be as large as a millimeter and would still have been undetected. This radical suggestion inspired a number of experimental groups to initiate a study of gravity at sub-millimeter distances in hopes of finding violations of the inverse square law. So far, none have been found, down to a tenth of a millimeter. Thus, even with today's state-of-the-art gravity experiments, if we are living within a three-brain, the extra dimensions could be as large as a tenth of a millimeter, and yet we wouldn't know it. This is one of the most striking realizations of the last decade. Using the three non-gravitational forces, we can probe down to about a billionth of a billionth, 10 to the minus 18th power of a meter, and no one has found any evidence of extra dimensions. But in the brain world scenario, the non-gravitational forces are impotent in searching for extra dimensions since they are trapped on the brain itself. Only gravity can give insight into the nature of the extra dimensions. And, as of today, the extra dimensions could be as thick as a human hair, and yet they'd be completely invisible to our most sophisticated instruments. Right now, right next to you, right next to me, and right next to everyone else, there could be another spatial dimension. A dimension beyond left-right, back-forth, and up-down. A dimension that's curled up, but still large enough to swallow something as thick as this page, that remains beyond our grasp. Large extra dimensions and large strings. By trapping three of the four forces, the brain world scenario significantly relaxes experimental constraints on how big the extra dimensions can be. But the extra dimensions aren't the only thing this approach allows to get bigger. Drawing on insights of Witten, Joe Lycan, Konstantin Backus, and others, Ignatios Antoniadis, together with Arkani Hamed, Dimopoulos, and Dvali, realized that in the brain world scenario, even unexcited, low-energy strings can be much larger than previously thought. In fact, the two scales, the size of extra dimensions and the size of strings, are closely related. Remember from the previous chapter that the basic size of string is determined by requiring that its graviton vibrational pattern communicate a gravitational force of the observed strength. The weakness of gravity translates into the strings being very short, about the Planck length, 10 to the minus 33rd power centimeters. But this conclusion is highly dependent on the size of the extra dimensions. The reason is that in string M theory, the strength of the gravitational force we observe in our three extended dimensions represents an interplay between two factors. One factor is the intrinsic, fundamental strength of the gravitational force. The second factor is the size of the extra dimensions. The larger the extra dimensions, the more gravity can spill into them, and the weaker its force will appear in the familiar dimensions. Just as larger pipes yield weaker water pressure because they allow water more room to spread out, so larger extra dimensions yield weaker gravity because they give gravity more room to spread out. The original calculations that determined the string's length assumed that the extra dimensions were so tiny, on the order of the Planck length, that gravity couldn't spill into them at all. Under this assumption, gravity appears weak because it is weak. But now, if we work in the brain world scenario and allow the extra dimensions to be much larger than had previously been considered, the observed feebleness of gravity no longer means that it's intrinsically weak. Instead, gravity could be a relatively powerful force that appears weak only because the relatively large extra dimensions, like large pipes, dilute its intrinsic strength. Following this line of reasoning, if gravity is much stronger than once thought, the strings can be much longer than once thought, too. As of today, the question of exactly how long doesn't have a unique, definite answer. With the newfound freedom to vary both the size of strings and the size of the extra dimensions over a much wider range than previously envisioned, there are a number of possibilities. Demopoulos and his collaborators have argued that existing experimental results, both from particle physics and from astrophysics, show that unexcited strings can't be larger than about a billionth of a meter, 10 to the minus 18th power meters. While small by everyday standards, this is about 100 million billion, 10 to the 17th power, times larger than the Planck length. Nearly 100 million billion times larger than previously thought. As we'll now see, that would be large enough that signs of strings could be detected by the next generation of particle accelerators. String theory confronts experiment. The possibility that we are living within a large three-brain is, of course, just that, a possibility. And within the brain world scenario, the possibility that the extra dimensions could be much larger than once thought, and the related possibility that strings could also be much larger than once thought, are also just that, possibilities. But they are tremendously exciting possibilities. True, even if the brain world scenario is right, the extra dimensions and the string size could still be Planckian. But the possibility within string M theory for strings and the extra dimensions to be much larger, to be just beyond the reach of today's technology, is fantastic. It means that there is at least a chance that in the next few years, string M theory will make contact with observable physics and become an experimental science. How big a chance? I don't know, and nor does anyone else. My intuition tells me it's unlikely, but my intuition is informed by a decade and a half of working within the conventional framework of Planck-sized strings and Planck-sized extra dimensions. Perhaps my instincts are old-fashioned. Thankfully, the question will be settled without the slightest concern for anyone's intuition. If the strings are big, or if some of the extra dimensions are big, the implications for upcoming experiments are spectacular. In the next chapter, we'll consider a variety of experiments that will test, among other things, the possibilities of comparatively large strings and large extra dimensions. So here, I will just whet your appetite. If strings are as large as a billionth of a billionth, 10^-18th power of a meter, the particles corresponding to the higher harmonic vibrations will not have enormous masses, in excess of the Planck mass, as in the standard scenario. Instead, their masses will be only 1,000 to a few thousand times that of a proton. And that's low enough to be within reach of the Large Hadron Collider, now being built at CERN. If these string vibrations were to be excited through high-energy collisions, the accelerator's detectors would light up like the Times Square crystal ball on New Year's Eve. A whole host of never-before-seen particles would be produced, and their masses would be related to one another's, much as the various harmonics are related on a cello. String theory's signature would be etched across the data with a flourish that would have impressed John Hancock. Researchers wouldn't be able to miss it, even without their glasses. Moreover, in the brain world scenario, high-energy collisions might even produce, get this, miniature black holes. Although we normally think of black holes as gargantuan structures out in deep space, it's been known since the early days of general relativity that if you crammed enough matter together in the palm of your hand, you'd create a tiny black hole. This doesn't happen because no one's grip, and no mechanical device, is even remotely strong enough to exert a sufficient compression force. Instead, the only accepted mechanism for black hole production involves the gravitational pull of an enormously massive star's overcoming the outward pressure normally exerted by the star's nuclear fusion processes, causing the star to collapse in on itself. But if gravity's intrinsic strength on small scales is far greater than previously thought, tiny black holes could be produced with significantly less compression force than previously believed. Calculations show that the Large Hadron Collider may have just enough squeezing power to create a cornucopia of microscopic black holes through high-energy collisions between protons. Think about how amazing that would be. The Large Hadron Collider might turn out to be a factory for producing microscopic black holes. These black holes would be so small and would last for such a short time that they wouldn't pose us the slightest threat. Years ago, Stephen Hawking showed that all black holes disintegrate via quantum processes, big ones very slowly, tiny ones very quickly. But their production would provide confirmation of some of the most exotic ideas ever contemplated. Brainworld Cosmology. A primary goal of current research, one that is being hotly pursued by scientists worldwide, including me, is to formulate an understanding of cosmology that incorporates the new insights of string M theory. The reason is clear. Not only does cosmology grapple with the big gulp-in-the-throat questions, and not only have we come to realize that aspects of familiar experience, such as the arrow of time, are bound up with conditions at the universe's birth, but cosmology also provides a theorist with what New York provided Sinatra, a proving ground par excellence. If a theory can make it in the extreme conditions characteristic of the universe's earliest moments, it can make it anywhere. As of today, cosmology according to string M theory is a work in progress, with researchers heading down two main pathways. The first, and more conventional approach, imagines that just as inflation provided a brief but profound front end to the standard Big Bang theory, string M theory provides a yet earlier and perhaps yet more profound front end to inflation. The vision is that string M theory will unfuzz the fuzzy patch we've used to denote our ignorance of the universe's earliest moments. And after that, the cosmological drama will unfold according to inflationary theory's remarkably successful script, recounted in earlier chapters. While there has been progress on specific details required by this vision, such as trying to understand why only three of the universe's spatial dimensions underwent expansion, as well as developing mathematical methods that may prove relevant to analyzing the spaceless, timeless realm that may precede inflation, the eureka moments have yet to occur. The intuition is that whereas inflationary cosmology imagines the observable universe getting ever smaller at ever earlier times, and hence being ever hotter, denser, and energetic, string M-theory tames this unruly, in physics speak, singular, behavior, by introducing a minimal size, as in our earlier discussion, below which new and less singular physical quantities become relevant. This reasoning lies at the heart of string M-theory's successful merger of general relativity and quantum mechanics. My gut feeling is that we will shortly determine how to apply the same reasoning in the context of cosmology. But, as of now, the fuzzy patch still looks fuzzy, and it's anybody's guess when clarity will be achieved. The second approach employs the brain world scenario, and in its most radical incarnation posits a completely new cosmological framework. It is far from clear whether this approach will survive detailed mathematical scrutiny, but it does provide a good example of how breakthroughs in fundamental theory can suggest novel trails through well-trodden territory. The proposal is called the cyclic model. Cyclic cosmology. From the standpoint of time, ordinary experience confronts us with two types of phenomena: those that have a clearly delineated beginning, middle, and end. This book, a baseball game, a human life. And those that are cyclic, happening over and over again. The changing seasons, the rising and setting of the sun, Larry King's weddings. Of course, on closer scrutiny, we learn that cyclic phenomena also have a beginning and end, since cycles do not generally go on forever. The sun has been rising and setting, that is, the Earth has been spinning on its axis while revolving around the sun, every day for some 5 billion years. But before that, the sun and the solar system had yet to form. And one day, some 5 billion years from now, the sun will turn into a red giant star, engulfing the inner planets, including Earth. And there will no longer even be a notion of a rising and setting sun, at least not here. But these are modern scientific recognitions. To the ancients, cyclic phenomena seemed eternally cyclic. And to many, the cyclic phenomena, running their course and continuously returning to begin anew, were the primary phenomena. The cycles of days and seasons set the rhythm of work and life. So it is no wonder that some of the oldest recorded cosmologies envision the unfolding of the world as a cyclical process. Rather than positing a beginning, a middle, and an end, a cyclic cosmology imagines that the world changes through time, much as the moon changes through phases. After it has passed through a complete sequence, conditions are ripe for everything to start afresh and initiate yet another cycle. Since the discovery of general relativity, a number of cyclic cosmological models have been proposed. The best known was developed in the 1930s by Richard Tolman of the California Institute of Technology. Tolman suggested that the observed expansion of the universe might slow down, someday stop, and then be followed by a period of contraction in which the universe got ever smaller. But instead of reaching a fiery finale, in which it implodes on itself and comes to an end, the universe might, Tolman proposed, undergo a bounce. Space might shrink down to some small size, and then rebound, initiating a new cycle of expansion, followed once again by contraction. A universe eternally repeating this cycle, expansion, contraction, bounce, expansion again, would elegantly avoid the thorny issues of origin. In such a scenario, the very concept of origin would be inapplicable, since the universe always was and would always be. But Tolman realized that looking back in time from today, the cycles could have repeated for a while, but not indefinitely. The reason is that during each cycle, The second law of thermodynamics dictates that entropy would, on average, rise. And according to general relativity, the amount of entropy at the beginning of each new cycle determines how long that cycle will last. More entropy means a longer period of expansion before the outward motion grinds to a halt and the inward motion takes over. So, each successive cycle would last much longer than its predecessor. Equivalently, earlier cycles would be shorter and shorter. When analyzed mathematically, the constant shortening of the cycles implies that they cannot stretch infinitely far into the past. Even in Tolman's cyclic framework, the universe would have a beginning. Tolman's proposal invoked a spherical universe, which, as we've seen, has been ruled out by observations. But a radically new incarnation of cyclic cosmology, involving a flat universe, has recently been developed within string M theory. The idea comes from Paul Steinhardt and his collaborator Neil Turok of Cambridge University. With heavy use of results discovered in their collaborations with Bert Ovrit, Nathan Seiberg, and Justin Khoury, and proposes a new mechanism for driving cosmic evolution. Briefly put, they suggest that we are living within a three-brain that violently collides every few trillion years with another nearby parallel three-brain. And the bang from the collision initiates each new cosmological cycle. The basic setup of the proposal is two three-brains separated by a short interval, and was suggested some years ago by Horjava and Witten in a non-cosmological context. Horjava and Witten were trying to complete Witten's proposed unity among all five-string theories, and found that if one of the seven extra dimensions in M-theory had a very simple shape, not a circle, but a little segment of a straight line, and was bounded by so-called end-of-the-world brains attached like bookends, then a direct connection could be made between the heterotic E-string theory and all others. The details of how they drew this connection are neither obvious nor of the essence. If you are interested, see, for example, The Elegant Universe, Chapter 12. What matters here is that it's a starting point that naturally emerges from the theory itself. Steinhardt and Turok enlisted it for their cosmological proposal. Specifically, Steinhardt and Turok imagine that each brain has three space dimensions, with the line segment between them providing a fourth space dimension. The remaining six space dimensions are curled up into a Calabi-Yau space that has the right shape for string vibrational patterns to account for the known particle species. The universe, of which we are directly aware, corresponds to one of these three brains. If you like, you can think of the second three brain as another universe, whose inhabitants, if any, would also be aware of only three space dimensions, assuming that their experimental technology and expertise did not greatly exceed ours. In this setup, then, another three brain, another universe, is right next door. It's hovering no more than a fraction of a millimeter away, the separation being in the fourth spatial dimension. But because our three-brain is so sticky, and the gravity we experience so weak, we have no direct evidence of its existence, nor its hypothetical inhabitants any evidence of ours. But, according to the cyclic cosmological model of Steinhardt and Turok, that isn't how it's always been, or how it will always be. Instead, in their approach, the two three-brains are attracted to each other, almost as though connected by tiny rubber bands, and this implies that each drives the cosmological evolution of the other. The brains engage in an endless cycle of collision, rebound, and collision once again, eternally regenerating their expanding three-dimensional worlds. To see how this goes, imagine the following, which illustrates one complete cycle, step by step. At stage one, the two three-brains have just rushed toward each other and slammed together, and are now rebounding. The tremendous energy of the collision deposits a significant amount of high-temperature radiation and matter on each of the rebounding three-brains. And, this is key, Steinhardt and Turok argue that, the detailed properties of this matter and radiation have a nearly identical profile to what's produced in the inflationary model. Although there is still some controversy on this point, Steinhardt and Turok therefore claim that the collision between the two three brains results in physical conditions extremely close to what they'd be a moment after the burst of inflationary expansion in the more conventional approach discussed in Chapter 10. Not surprisingly, then, to a hypothetical observer within our three brain, the next few stages in the cyclic cosmological model are essentially the same as those in the standard approach, where that figure is now interpreted as depicting evolution on one of the three brains. Namely, as our three brain rebounds from the collision, it expands and cools, and cosmic structures, such as stars and galaxies, gradually coalesce from the primordial plasma. Then, inspired by the recent supernova observations discussed in Chapter 10, Steinhardt and Turok configure their model so that about 7 billion years into the cycle, stage 3, the energy in ordinary matter and radiation becomes sufficiently diluted by the expansion of the brain so that a dark energy component gains the upper hand, and through its negative pressure, drives an era of accelerated expansion. This requires an arbitrary tuning of details, but it allows the model to match observation, and so the cyclic model's proponents argue is well motivated. About 7 billion years later, we humans find ourselves here on Earth, at least in the current cycle, experiencing the early stages of the accelerated phase. Then, for roughly the next trillion years, not much new happens beyond our three brains' continued accelerated expansion. That's long enough for our three-dimensional space to have stretched by such a colossal factor that matter and radiation are diluted almost completely away, leaving the brain world looking almost completely empty and completely uniform. Stage 4. By this point, our three brain has completed its rebound from the initial collision and has started to approach the second three brain once again. As we get closer and closer to another collision, quantum jitters of the strings attached to our brain overlie its uniform emptiness with tiny ripples. Stage 5. As we continue to pick up speed, the ripples continue to grow. Then, in a cataclysmic collision, we smack into the second three brain. We bounce off, and the cycle starts anew. The quantum ripples imprint tiny inhomogeneities in the radiation and matter produced during the collision. And, much as in the inflationary scenario, these deviations from perfect uniformity grow into clumps that ultimately generate stars and galaxies. These are the major stages in the cyclic model, also known tenderly as the Big Splat. Its premise, colliding brain worlds, is very different from that of the successful inflationary theory, but there are nevertheless significant points of contact between the two approaches. That both rely on quantum agitation to generate initial non-uniformities is one essential similarity. In fact, Steinhardt and Turok argue that the equations governing the quantum ripples in the cyclic model are nearly identical to those in the inflationary picture. So the resulting non-uniformities predicted by the two theories are nearly identical as well. Moreover, while there isn't an inflationary burst in the cyclic model, there is a trillion-year period, beginning at stage 3, of milder accelerated expansion. But it's really just a matter of haste versus patience. What the inflationary model accomplishes in a flash, the cyclic model accomplishes in a comparative eternity. Since the collision in the cyclic model is not the beginning of the universe, there is the luxury of slowly resolving cosmological issues, like the flatness and horizon problems, during the final trillion years of each previous cycle. Eons of gentle but steady accelerated expansion at the end of each cycle stretch our three brain nice and flat, and except for tiny but important quantum fluctuations, make it thoroughly uniform. And so the long final stage of each cycle, followed by the splat at the beginning of the next cycle, yields an environment very close to that produced by the short surge of expansion in the inflationary approach. A brief assessment. At their present levels of development, both the inflationary and the cyclic models provide insightful cosmological frameworks, but neither offers a complete theory. Ignorance of the prevailing conditions during the universe's earliest moments forces proponents of inflationary cosmology to simply assume, without theoretical justification, that the conditions required for initiating inflation arose. If they did, the theory resolves numerous cosmological conundrums and launches time's arrow. But such successes hinge on inflation's happening in the first place. What's more, inflationary cosmology has not been seamlessly embedded within string theory, and so is not yet part of a consistent merger of quantum mechanics and general relativity. The cyclic has its own share of shortcomings. As with Tolman's model, consideration of entropy buildup, and also of quantum mechanics, ensures that the cyclic model's cycles could not have gone on forever. Instead, the cycles began at some definite time in the past. And so, as with inflation, we need an explanation of how the first cycle got started. If it did, then the theory, also like inflation, resolves the key cosmological problems and sets time's arrow pointing from each low-entropy splat forward through its ensuing stages. But, as it's currently conceived, the cyclic model offers no explanation of how or why the universe finds itself in the necessary configuration. Why, for instance, do six dimensions curl themselves up into a particular Calabi-Yau shape, while one of the extra dimensions dutifully takes the shape of a spatial segment separating two three-brains? How is it that the two end-of-the-world three-brains line up so perfectly and attract each other with just the right force so that the stages proceed as we've described? And of critical importance, what actually happens when the two three-brains collide in the cyclic model's version of a bang? On this last question, there is hope that the cyclic model's splat is less problematic than the singularity encountered at time zero in inflationary cosmology. Instead of all of space being infinitely compressed, in the cyclic approach, only the single dimension between the brains gets squeezed down. The brains themselves experience overall expansion, not contraction, during each cycle. And this, Steinhardt, Turok, and their collaborators have argued, implies finite temperature and finite densities on the brains themselves. But this is a highly tentative conclusion, because so far no one has been able to get the better of the equations and figure out what would happen should brains slam together. In fact, the analyses so far completed point toward the splat being subject to the same problem that afflicts the inflationary theory at time zero. The mathematics breaks down. Thus, cosmology is still in need of a compelling resolution of its singular start, be it the true start of the universe or the start of our current cycle. The most compelling feature of the cyclic model is the way it incorporates dark energy and the observed accelerated expansion. In 1998, when it was discovered that the universe is undergoing accelerated expansion, it was quite a surprise to most physicists and astronomers. While it can be incorporated into the inflationary cosmological picture by assuming that the universe contains precisely the right amount of dark energy, accelerated expansion seems like a clumsy add-on. In the cyclic model, by contrast, dark energy's role is natural and pivotal. The trillion-year period of slow but steadily accelerated expansion is crucial for wiping the slate clean, for diluting the observable universe to near nothingness, and for resetting conditions in preparation for the next cycle. From this point of view, both the inflationary model and the cyclic model rely on accelerated expansion. The inflationary model near its beginning, and the cyclic model at the end of each of its cycles. but only the latter has direct observational support. Remember, the cyclic approach is designed so that we are just entering the trillion-year phase of accelerated expansion. And such expansion has been recently observed. That's a tick in the cyclic models column. But it also means that should accelerated expansion fail to be confirmed by future observations, the inflationary model could survive. Although the puzzle of the missing 70% of the universe's energy budget would emerge anew. But the cyclic model could not. New visions of space-time. The brain world scenario and the cyclic cosmological model it spawned are both highly speculative. I have discussed them here not so much because I feel certain that they are correct, as because I want to illustrate the striking new ways of thinking about the space we inhabit and the evolution it has experienced that have been inspired by string M theory. If we are living within a three-brain, the centuries-old question regarding the corporeality of three-dimensional space would have its most definite answer. Space would be a brain, and hence would most definitely be a something. It might also not be anything particularly special, as there could be many other brains, of various dimensions, floating within string M theory's higher dimensional expanse. And if cosmological evolution on our three brain is driven by repeated collisions with a nearby brain, time as we know it would span only one of the universe's many cycles, with one big bang followed by another, and then another. To me, it's a vision that's both exciting and humbling. There may be much more to space and time than we anticipated. If there is, what we consider to be everything may be but a small constituent of a far richer reality. Part 5. Reality and Imagination. Chapter 14. Experimenting with Space and Time. Up in the heavens and down in the earth. We've come a long way since Empedocles of Agrigento explained the universe using earth, air, fire, and water. And much of the progress we've made, from Newton through the revolutionary discoveries of the 20th century, has been borne out spectacularly by experimental confirmation of detailed and precise theoretical predictions. But since the mid-1980s, we've been the victims of our own success. With the incessant urge to push the limits of understanding ever further, our theories have entered realms beyond the reach of our current technology. Nevertheless, with diligence and luck, many forefront ideas will be tested during the next few decades. As we'll discuss in this chapter, experiments, either planned or underway, have the potential to give much insight into the existence of extra dimensions, the composition of dark matter and dark energy, the origin of mass and the Higgs ocean, aspects of early universe cosmology, the relevance of supersymmetry, and, possibly, the veracity of string theory itself. And so, with a fair bit more luck, some imaginative and innovative ideas regarding unification, the nature of space and time, and our cosmic origins may finally be tested. Einstein in drag. In his decade-long struggle to formulate the general theory of relativity, Einstein sought inspiration from a variety of sources. Most influential of all were insights into the mathematics of curved shapes developed in the 19th century by mathematical luminaries, including Carl Friedrich Gauss, Janosz Bolyai, Nikolai Lobachevsky, and Georg Bernhard Riemann. As we discussed in Chapter 3, Einstein was also inspired by the ideas of Ernst Mach. Remember that Mach advocated a relational conception of space. For him, space provided the language for specifying the location of one object relative to another, but was not itself an independent entity. Initially, Einstein was an enthusiastic champion of Mach's perspective, because it was the most relative that a theory espousing relativity could be. But as Einstein's understanding of general relativity deepened, he realized that it did not incorporate Mach's ideas fully. According to general relativity, the water in Newton's bucket, spinning in an otherwise empty universe, would take on a concave shape. And this conflicts with Mach's purely relational perspective, since it implies an absolute notion of acceleration. Even so, general relativity does incorporate some aspects of Mach's viewpoint, and within the next few years, a more than $500 million experiment that has been in development for close to 40 years will test one of the most prominent Machian features. The physics to be studied has been known since 1918, when the Austrian researchers Joseph Lenz and Hans Thiering used general relativity to show that just as a massive object warps space and time, like a bowling ball resting on a trampoline, so a rotating object drags space and time around it, like a spinning stone immersed in a bucket of syrup. This is known as frame dragging, and implies, for example, that an asteroid freely falling toward a rapidly rotating neutron star or black hole will get caught up in a whirlpool of spinning space and be whipped around as it journeys downward. The effect is called frame dragging because, from the point of view of the asteroid, from its frame of reference, it isn't being whipped around at all. Instead, it's as if it's falling straight down along the spatial grid. But because space is swirling, the grid gets twisted. So the meaning of straight down differs from what you'd expect based on a distant, non-swirling perspective. To see the connection to Mach, think about a version of frame dragging in which the massive rotating object is a huge hollow sphere. Calculations initiated in 1912 by Einstein, even before he completed general relativity, which were significantly extended in 1965 by Dieter Brill and Jeffrey Cohen, and finally completed in 1985 by the German physicists Herbert Pfister and K. Brown, showed that space inside the hollow sphere would be dragged by the rotational motion and set into a whirlpool-like spin. If a stationary bucket filled with water, stationary as viewed from a distant vantage point, were placed inside such a rotating sphere, the calculations show that the spinning space would exert a force on the stationary water, causing it to rise up the bucket walls and take on a concave shape. This result would have pleased Mach no end. Although he might not have liked the description in terms of spinning space, since this phrase portrays space-time as a something, he would have found it extremely gratifying that relative spinning motion between the sphere and the bucket causes the water's shape to change. In fact, for a shell that contains enough mass, an amount on a par with that contained in the entire universe, the calculations show that it doesn't matter one bit whether you think the hollow sphere is spinning around the bucket, or the bucket is spinning within the hollow sphere. Just as Mach advocated, the only thing that matters is the relative spinning motion between the two. And since the calculations I've referred to make use of nothing but general relativity, this is an explicit example of a distinctly Machian feature of Einstein's theory. Nevertheless, whereas standard Machian reasoning would claim that the water would stay flat if the bucket spun in an infinite empty universe, general relativity disagrees. What the Pfister and Brown results show is that a sufficiently massive rotating sphere is able to completely block the usual influence of the space that lies beyond the sphere itself. In 1960, Leonard Schiff of Stanford University and George Pugh of the U.S. Department of Defense independently suggested that general relativity's prediction of frame dragging might be experimentally tested using the rotational motion of the Earth. Schiff and Pugh realized that according to Newtonian physics, a spinning gyroscope, a spinning wheel that's attached to an axis, floating in orbit high above the Earth's surface, would point in a fixed and unchanging direction. But according to general relativity, its axis would rotate ever so slightly because of the Earth's dragging of space. Since the Earth's mass is puny in comparison with the hypothetical hollow sphere used in the Pfister and Brown calculation above, the degree of frame dragging caused by the Earth's rotation is tiny. The detailed calculations show that if the gyroscope's spin axis were initially directed toward a chosen reference star, a year later, slowly swirling space would shift the direction of its axis by about 1/100,000th of a degree. That's the angle the second hand on a clock sweeps through in roughly 2/1,000,000ths of a second. So its detection presents a major scientific, technological, and engineering challenge. 4 decades of development and nearly 100 doctoral dissertations later, a Stanford team led by Francis Everett and funded by NASA is ready to give the experiment a go. During the next few years, their Gravity Probe B satellite, floating 400 miles out in space and outfitted with 4 of the most stable gyroscopes ever built, will attempt to measure frame dragging caused by the Earth's rotation. If the experiment is successful, it will be one of the most precise confirmations of general relativity ever achieved, and will provide the first direct evidence of a Machian effect. Equally exciting is the possibility that the experiments will detect a deviation from what general relativity predicts. Such a tiny crack in general relativity's foundation might be just what we need to gain an experimental glimpse into hitherto hidden features of space-time. Catching the Wave. An essential lesson of general relativity is that mass and energy cause the fabric of space-time to warp. We illustrated this earlier by showing the curved environment surrounding the Sun. One limitation of a still figure, though, is that it fails to illustrate how the warps and curves in space evolve when mass and energy move or in some way change their configuration. General relativity predicts that, just as a trampoline assumes a fixed, warped shape if you stand perfectly still, but heaves when you jump up and down, space can assume a fixed, warped shape if matter is perfectly still. But ripples undulate through its fabric when matter moves to and fro. Einstein came to this realization between 1916 and 1918, when he used the newly fashioned equations of general relativity to show that, much as electric charges racing up and down a broadcast antenna produce electromagnetic waves, this is how radio and television waves are produced, matter racing this way and that, as in a supernova explosion, produces gravitational waves. And since gravity is curvature, a gravitational wave is a wave of curvature. Just as tossing a pebble into a pond generates outward-spreading water ripples, gyrating matter generates outward-spreading spatial ripples. According to general relativity, a distant supernova explosion is like a cosmic pebble that's been tossed into a space-time pond. This highlights an important distinguishing feature of gravitational waves. Unlike electromagnetic, sound, and water waves, waves that travel through space, gravitational waves travel within space. They are traveling distortions in the geometry of space itself. While gravitational waves are now an accepted prediction of general relativity, for many years the subject was mired in confusion and controversy, at least in part because of over-adherence to Machian philosophy. If general relativity fully incorporated Mach's ideas, then the geometry of space would merely be a convenient language for expressing the location and motion of one massive object with respect to another. Empty space, in this way of thinking, would be an empty concept. So how could it be sensible to speak of empty space wiggling? Many physicists tried to prove that the supposed waves in space amounted to a misinterpretation of the mathematics of general relativity. But in due course, the theoretical analyses converged on the correct conclusion. Gravitational waves are real, and space can ripple. With every passing peak and trough, a gravitational wave's distorted geometry would stretch space, and everything in it, in one direction, and then compress space, and everything in it, in a perpendicular direction. In principle, you could detect the gravitational waves passing by repeatedly measuring distances between a variety of locations, and finding that the ratios between these distances had momentarily changed. In practice, no one has been able to do this, so no one has directly detected a gravitational wave. However, there is compelling indirect evidence for gravitational waves. The difficulty is that the distorting influence of a passing gravitational wave is typically minute. The atomic bomb tested at Trinity on July 16, 1945, packed a punch equivalent to 20,000 tons of TNT, and was so bright that witnesses miles away had to wear eye protection to avoid serious damage from the electromagnetic waves it generated. Yet, even if you were standing right under the 100-foot steel tower on which the bomb was hoisted, the gravitational waves its explosion produced would have stretched your body one way or another only by a minuscule fraction of an atomic diameter. That's how comparatively feeble gravitational disturbances are, and it gives an inkling of the technological challenges involved in detecting them. Since a gravitational wave can also be thought of as a huge number of gravitons traveling in a coordinated manner, just as an electromagnetic wave is composed of a huge number of coordinated photons, this also gives an inkling of how difficult it is to detect a single graviton. Of course, we're not particularly interested in detecting gravitational waves produced by nuclear weapons, but the situation with astrophysical sources is not much easier. The closer and more massive the astrophysical source, and the more energetic and violent the motion involved, the stronger the gravitational waves we would receive. But even if a star at a distance of 10,000 light-years were to go supernova, as the resulting gravitational wave passed by Earth, it would stretch a 1-meter-long rod by only a millionth of a billionth of a centimeter, barely a hundredth the size of an atomic nucleus. So, unless some highly unexpected astrophysical event of truly cataclysmic proportions were to happen relatively nearby, detecting a gravitational wave will require an apparatus capable of responding to fantastically small length changes. The scientists who designed and built the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO, being run jointly by the California Institute of Technology and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and funded by the National Science Foundation, have risen to the challenge. LIGO is impressive, and the expected sensitivity is astounding. It consists of two hollow tubes, each 4 kilometers long and a bit over a meter wide, which are arranged in a giant L. Laser light simultaneously shot down vacuum tunnels inside each tube and reflected back by highly polished mirrors is used to measure the relative length of each to fantastic accuracy. The idea is that if a gravitational wave should roll by, it will stretch one tube relative to the other. And if the stretching is big enough, scientists will be able to detect it. The tubes are long because the stretching and compressing accomplished by a gravitational wave is cumulative. If a gravitational wave were to stretch something 4 meters long by, say, 10 to the minus 20th power meters, it would stretch something 4 kilometers long by 1,000 times as much, 10 to the minus 17th power meters. So the longer the span being monitored, the easier it is to detect a change in its length. To capitalize on this, the LIGO experimenters actually direct the laser beams to bounce back and forth between mirrors at opposite ends of each tube more than 100 times on each run, increasing the round-trip distance being monitored to about 800 kilometers per beam. With such clever tricks and engineering feats, LIGO should be able to detect any change in the tube lengths that exceeds a trillionth of the thickness of a human hair, 100 millionth the size of an atom. Oh, and there are actually two of these L-shaped devices. One is in Livingston, Louisiana, and the other is about 2,000 miles away in Hanford, Washington. If a gravity wave from some distant astrophysical hullabaloo rolls by Earth, it should affect each detector identically. So any wave caught by one experiment had better also show up in the other. This is an important consistency check, since for all the precautions that have been taken to shield the detectors, the disturbances of everyday life, the rumble of a passing truck, the grinding of a chainsaw, the impact of a falling tree, and so on, could masquerade as gravitational waves. Requiring coincidence between distant detectors serves to rule out these false positives. Researchers have also carefully calculated the gravitational wave frequencies, the number of peaks and troughs that should pass by their detector each second, that they expect to be produced by a range of astrophysical phenomena, including supernova explosions, the rotational motion of non-spherical neutron stars, and collisions between black holes. Without this information, the experimenters would be looking for a needle in a haystack. With it, they can focus the detectors on a sharply defined frequency band of physical interest. Curiously, the calculations reveal that some gravitational wave frequencies should be in the range of a few thousand cycles per second. If these were sound waves, they'd be right in the range of human audibility. Coalescing neutron stars would sound like a chirp with a rapidly rising pitch, while a pair of colliding black holes would mimic the trill of a sparrow that's received a sharp blow to the chest. There's a jungle-like cacophony of gravitational waves oscillating through the space-time fabric. And if all goes according to plan, LIGO will be the first instrument to tune in. What makes this all so exciting is that gravitational waves maximize the utility of gravity's two main features: its weakness and its ubiquity. Of all four forces, gravity interacts with matter most feebly. This implies that gravitational waves can pass through material that's opaque to light, giving access to astrophysical realms previously hidden. What's more, because everything is subject to gravity, whereas, for example, the electromagnetic force only affects objects carrying an electric charge, everything has the capacity to generate gravitational waves and hence produce an observable signature. LIGO thereby marks a significant turning point in the way we examine the cosmos. I call these goals prosaic, not because they are uninteresting, but because in the intervening years, a significant amount of indirect evidence has accumulated which suggests strongly that all will work out precisely as general relativity predicts. Nevertheless, the beauty of science is its ability to surprise. Who knows? Things might not turn out as we expect. But even if the predictions of general relativity are borne out fully, LIGO undoubtedly marks a new chapter in human exploration. There was a time when all we could do was raise our eyes and gaze skyward. In the 17th century, Hans Lippershey and Galileo Galilei changed that. With the aid of the telescope, the grand vista of the cosmos came within humanity's purview. But in time we realized that visible light represented a narrow band of electromagnetic waves. In the 20th century, with the aid of infrared, radio, X-ray, and gamma-ray telescopes, the cosmos opened up to us anew, revealing wonders invisible in the wavelengths of light that our eyes have evolved to see. Now, in the 21st century, we are opening up the heavens once again. With LIGO and its subsequent improvements, we will view the cosmos in a completely new way. Rather than using electromagnetic waves, we will use gravitational waves. Rather than using the electromagnetic force, we will use the gravitational force. To appreciate how revolutionary this new technology may be, imagine a world on which alien scientists were just now discovering how to detect electromagnetic waves, light. And think about how their view of the universe would, in short order, profoundly change. We are on the cusp of our first detection of gravitational waves, and so may well be in a similar position. For millennia, we have looked into the cosmos. Now it's as if, for the first time in human history, we will listen to it. The Hunt for Extra Dimensions. Before 1996, most theoretical models that incorporated extra dimensions imagined that their spatial extent was roughly Planckian, 10 to the minus 33rd power centimeters. As this is 17 orders of magnitude smaller than anything resolvable using currently available equipment, without the discovery of miraculous new technology, Planckian physics will remain out of reach. But if the extra dimensions are large, meaning larger than 1/100th of a billionth of a billionth, 10 to the minus 20th power of a meter, about 1/1,000,000th the size of an atomic nucleus, there is hope. As we discussed in Chapter 13, if any of the extra dimensions are very large, within a few orders of magnitude of a millimeter, precision measurements of gravity strength should reveal their existence. Such experiments have been underway for a few years, and the techniques are being rapidly refined. So far, no deviations from the inverse square law characteristic of three space dimensions have been found, so researchers are pressing on to smaller distances. A positive signal would, to say the least, rock the foundations of physics. It would provide compelling evidence of extra dimensions accessible only to gravity, and that would give strong circumstantial support for the brain-world scenario of string M theory. If the extra dimensions are large, but not very large, precision gravity experiments will be unlikely to detect them. But other indirect approaches remain available. For example, we mentioned earlier that large extra dimensions would imply that gravity's intrinsic strength is greater than previously thought. The observed weakness of gravity would be attributed to its leaking out into the extra dimensions, not to its being fundamentally feeble. On short-distance scales, before such leakage occurs, gravity would be strong. Among other implications, this means that the creation of tiny black holes would require far less mass and energy than it would in a universe in which gravity is intrinsically far weaker. In Chapter 13, we discuss the possibility that such microscopic black holes might be produced by high-energy proton-proton collisions at the Large Hadron Collider, the particle accelerator now under construction in Geneva, Switzerland, and slated for completion by 2007. That is an exciting prospect. But there is another tantalizing possibility that was raised by Alfred Shapir of the University of Kentucky and Jonathan Fung of the University of California at Irvine. These researchers noted that cosmic rays, elementary particles that stream through space and continually bombard our atmosphere, might also initiate production of microscopic black holes. Cosmic ray particles were discovered in 1912 by the Austrian scientist Victor Hess. More than 9 decades later, they still present many mysteries. Every second, cosmic rays slam into the atmosphere and initiate a cascade of billions of downward-raining particles that pass through your body and mine. Some of them are detected by a variety of dedicated instruments worldwide. But no one is completely sure what kinds of particles constitute the impinging cosmic rays, although there is a growing consensus that they are protons. And, despite the fact that some of these high-energy particles are believed to come from supernova explosions, no one has any idea of where the highest-energy cosmic ray particles originate. For example, on October 15, 1991, the Fly's Eye cosmic ray detector in the Utah desert measured a particle streaking across the sky with an energy equivalent to 30 billion proton masses. That's almost as much energy in a single subatomic particle as in a Mariano Rivera fastball, and is about 100 times the size of the particle energies that will be produced by the Large Hadron Collider. The puzzling thing is that no known astrophysical process could produce particles with such high energy. Experimenters are gathering more data with more sensitive detectors in hopes of solving the mystery. For Shapir and Feng, the origin of super-energetic cosmic gray particles was of secondary concern. They realized that regardless of where such particles come from, if gravity on microscopic scales is far stronger than formerly thought, the highest energy cosmic ray particles might have just enough oomph to create tiny black holes when they violently slam into the upper atmosphere. As with their production in atom smashers, such tiny black holes would pose absolutely no danger to the experimenters or the world at large. After their creation, they would quickly disintegrate, sending off a characteristic cascade of other, more ordinary particles. In fact, the microscopic black holes would be so short-lived that experimenters would not search for them directly. Instead, they would look for evidence of black holes through detailed studies of the resulting particle showers raining down on their detectors. The most sensitive of the world's cosmic ray detectors, the Pierre Auger Observatory, with an observing area the size of Rhode Island, is now being built on a vast stretch of land in western Argentina. Shapir and Feng estimate that if all of the extra dimensions are as large as 10 to the minus 14th power meters, then, after a year's worth of data collection, the Auger detector will see the characteristic particle debris from about a dozen tiny black holes produced in the upper atmosphere. If such black hole signatures are not found, the experiment will conclude that extra dimensions are smaller. Finding the remains of black holes produced in cosmic ray collisions is certainly a long shot, but success would open the first experimental window on extra dimensions, black holes, string theory, and quantum gravity. Beyond black hole production, there is another accelerator-based way that researchers will be looking for extra dimensions during the next decade. The idea is a sophisticated variant on the space between the cushions explanation for the loose coins missing from your pocket. A central principle of physics is conservation of energy. Energy can manifest itself in many forms. The kinetic energy of a ball's motion as it flies off a baseball bat, gravitational potential energy as the ball flies upward, sound and heat energy when the ball hits the ground and excites all sorts of vibrational motion, the mass energy that's locked inside the ball itself, and so on. But when all carriers of energy have been accounted for, the amount with which you end always equals